And of course, Linda Moulton Howe with us as we talk about some more fascinating stories. Up next, Comet ISON headed for a close approach to our sun just a few months from now. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Linda, this comet, if it gets close to the sun, will it do anything to good old planet Earth?
No, it's what is the sun going to do to Comet ISON? It could end up melting away completely. And astronomers have assumed that this comet is making its very first trip from the Oort cloud into the solar system. The Oort cloud surrounds our solar system, and it's, you can think of it as a cold place, icy remnants left over from when we were making planets and moons and all of that inside of this solar system. And if you were at the sun and you went out about one half a light year, it's really out there, 3 trillion some miles from the sun, you'd get to what is called the edge of the Oort cloud. And out there is where all the makings of comets and ice and all of that are. So when there's something this primordial and new that is coming through, it has stirred a great deal of interest because it's sort of like looking back at a slice at the very beginning of the solar system, what was happening. And that's why scientists want to study this from every place, the ground, balloons, telescopes, anything that they can. And it's so interesting that this ice has been traveling for millions of miles, and it was between Jupiter and Saturn on September 20th of 2012, not quite a year ago, and it began to warm up and release gases. And that's when two Russian scientists were working with a telescope in a Russian observatory. They were out there to survey for comets and asteroids in the International Scientific Optical Network, known as ISON. And these two scientists found a blur on an electronic image, and they loaded the image into their computer program designed to detect asteroids and comets moving between images. And they thought maybe they had a comet. And the next day, on September 21st of 2012, after more telescope time, the new image confirmed that this, in fact, was a comet, and they decided to name it Comet ISON after that International Scientific Optical Network that they were doing all this work for. And since that comet flared up enough to be visible so far from Earth, NASA reported that perhaps Comet ISON, quote, could brighten into one of the brightest comets ever. It's possible. Alternatively, the comet could break up when it gets closer to the sun or brighten much more modestly. Sky enthusiasts the world over are all abuzz, though, from the more optimistic speculations that this newly discovered Comet ISON could develop a spectacular tail or briefly approach the brightness of the full moon toward the end of 2013, close quote. And by April 10th, not very long ago, the Hubble Space Telescope was able to photograph Comet ISON much more clearly. And I have a beautiful Hubble Telescope image of Comet ISON at my news website, earthfiles.com, right now that you can see. It will be closest to the sun at about 640,000 to 700,000 miles above the sun's surface on November 28th. That's Thanksgiving Day, 2013. And then whatever is left of it, after grazing the sun's heat, it will head back out of the solar system toward the Oort cloud, coming closest to Earth a month later on December 26, 2013, when it will be about 40 million miles from the Earth, but probably pretty dim, and no one knows how much of it will be left. Recently, I talked with Carl Hibbets, PhD. He's a research scientist at Johns Hopkins University's Applied Physics Laboratory in Baltimore, Maryland. He is participating in what is called Comet ISON Balloon Rapid Response Project, known also as BRISON. Here now is Dr. Hibbets from Baltimore.
Comet ISON. is brand new to the solar system, so it has really volatile ices in it, ices that evaporate at low temperatures. Because this comet has not been to this solar system before, these ices are still present in great abundance, and so the comet was brighter than usual, further away from the sun, but comets are incredibly unpredictable.
What is this Balloon Rapid Response ISON project?
Right. One of the most important things to measure on comets, especially primordial ones, and we almost never get a chance to, is the ratio of carbon dioxide to water, because this gives us an understanding and insight into the formation characteristics of the solar system, you know, 4.5 billion years ago. It's in a cold, dark reservoir really far away outside of the solar system. And so when it comes in, all those primordial volatiles that have been sitting there for billions of years start to evaporate and leave the surface. And that is how these scientists detected this comet a little bit beyond the orbit of Jupiter. So probably it was carbon monoxide that was coming off. It evaporates about 30 Kelvin. So it starts evaporating once you get inside the orbit of Neptune. So the comet got quite bright outside the orbit of Jupiter. They detected it. And because of that detection, we were able to realize and plan for this close passage of the comet to the sun. Right now, carbon dioxide is boiling off quite a bit, okay? And it will continue to boil off until probably the comet gets much closer to the sun. When the comet gets within a few AU of the sun, like 3, water will start to boil off. And so we're hoping that it'll get even brighter in the CO2 region.
Where is Comet ISON right now as we speak in mid-July of 2013?
It's on the other side of the sun. We can't observe it. It's probably somewhere beyond the orbit of Mars.
So when will be the very first time we will actually be able to see with our visible eyes Comet ISON?
Probably November, early November.
And when does this Balloon Rapid Response ISON team kick into gear? What will it do?
It will measure the ratio of carbon dioxide to water that's being evaporating off the surface of Comet ISON. And by understanding what that ratio is, we get insights into the composition of Oort cloud and the original components of volatiles in our solar system.
How high will this balloon go and what will happen?
So the balloon launches between September 17th and October 15th. And that launch dates are set by when the NASA Balloon Program Office is available to launch it, because there is an existing capability in NASA to fly very high altitude balloons with payloads. And these balloons can launch from New Mexico, Australia, New Zealand, Antarctica, but they only launch certain times of the year from each of the locations. And it turns out that the New Mexico launch site is pretty well suited for observing Comet ISON because the launch window, which is constrained by the winds, at altitude, which is about 100,000 feet, vary with the time of year. And it's important that the balloons don't actually fly over populated areas because, you know, some disaster happened. We don't want the balloon and its payload to crash down on top of people. So based off of these various constraints, we're flying out of Fort Sumner, New Mexico, and we launch it early morning because that's when winds are calmest, around 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. It takes about 2 hours to get up to float altitude. So we get up to float around 10 o'clock.
And that's about 100 to 120,000 feet. And that's about 23 miles up.
I think in terms of kilometers, okay, about 23 miles. Not quite the edge of space. The edge of space is technically 100 kilometers, but we're high up. We're in the upper stratosphere. We're above 99.5% of all the atmosphere. And we're above absolutely all the water in the atmosphere. And we're above most of the carbon dioxide. But, you know, carbon dioxide is well mixed in our atmosphere, so it's above us as well as below us. There's still CO2 above us, and, of course, it makes it kind of murky to look through when we're looking for CO2 on the comet, but we can do it. And we get to float altitude at about 11 o'clock, 10 or 11, and we do tests on the telescope. We unstow it. We make sure we can point it correctly and control the gondola correctly. You've got to think about this. We have a 5,000-pound gondola sitting at the end of a 100-foot rope that is attached to a absolutely huge balloon, millions of cubic feet of helium. Now, the gondola will be turning on the rope, will be swinging back and forth, and we have to hold that gondola rather rock steady. It's So it doesn't twist, doesn't rock back and forth or side to side very much. Now we can control the twisting with a gyroscope, and the up and down part, we compensate for that with a telescope that moves up and down.
Along with the telescope, is it true that you'll have infrared gear?
Yes, because we have two imaging systems behind this telescope. The infrared gear, mid-infrared, not thermo-infrared, but you can still see heat with it. Interestingly, that's part of the problem. Because the instrument is so sensitive, we see the heat from the atmosphere, even though we're up so high. We even see the heat from the telescope mirrors, even though they're shiny and don't produce much heat. The comet is so dim that the comet is dimmer than the heat that the telescope itself is emitting. So it's a very interesting observational challenge.
It's going to be closest to the sun on November 28th, Thanksgiving Day in the U.S.
You are absolutely right. How I wish we could launch late November, right?
Yeah.
But we can't because we're constrained by the available launch locations and times. So if we launch later than the 1st of October, the winds at altitude start picking up.
And so this balloon rapid response for ISON is going to launch from Fort Sumner, New Mexico, Columbia Scientific Balloon Flight Facility by no later than the first week of October.
No later than October 15th.
What scientific research picks up in November beyond your balloon research?
There's a whole campaign of observations being coordinated by NASA and other scientists using ground-based observatories. There's going to be a very large number of observations closer to perihelion when the comet gets very close to the sun and the surface of it actually starts to boil away. Not just the ice, but the rock begins to boil.
And is that when it is supposed to maybe be as bright as a full moon?
Yeah, that's about it. Yes. Now, you have to realize the full moon next to the bright sun. So it's not going to be very bright. It'll be hard to even see the comet because it's next to the sun. Time to see it would be early morning. It's going to be a morning comet, so it will rise before the sun does.
So what date and time would be the best for everyone listening if they want to get up to try to see Comet ISON at its brightest and to see possibly it looking sort of like the brightness of a full moon? When would be the optimum date and time?
I would probably start looking within 2 weeks of perihelion.
And so the idea of something like a Halley's Comet that was sketched as covering a good portion of the sky, Comet ISON, it's not going to be big.
It won't be that big, but it could cover several degrees of the sky. They're really hard to predict.
So we have a true mystery coming in November that scientists do not even know what Comet ISON is going to look like.
So true. Certainly this brand new one, they're impossible to predict. We have no idea really how bright it will be. We've only recently realized it's maybe 1 kilometer in diameter. That's all. So it's amazing such a small object can be seen at all.
Why is this comet going to be so bright if it's only 1 kilometer in diameter?
When the gas comes off, it continues to follow the trajectory of the comet, but then the gas particles are pushed away by the solar pressure. And the dust comes off, follows the trajectory of the comet. The brightness or the extent of it is the fact that the gas and the dust can extend for many millions of miles. So when the comet is closer to the Earth, it looks much, much bigger, even if it survives passage, which is by no means guaranteed. Because it's getting within a tenth of a solar radii or so of the sun, it can just be split up into many small pieces, which themselves would evaporate away, and there'll just be a dust and gas tail that continues around the sun, following the orbit the comet would have made, and then that will fade in time, and there'll be nothing left. Or the comet might survive in one piece or many pieces and go back out to the Oort cloud. We really don't know.
So after November 28th, there is no guarantee that we would have a full comet to look at from Earth?
None at all.
What will scientists have learned up to that date of November 28th before this comet might likely dissipate?
One of the more interesting things is measuring the composition and abundance of the rock pebbles, you know, the dirt that the comet is made of, understanding what that is, that's truly unique. And you can only do that either by visiting a comet with a spacecraft, or if the comet's a sun grazer, look at it with a special solar telescope that has a spectrometer on the back of it that can do spectroscopy of the superheated gases that have boiled off from the surface. It's very unusual to be able to make that measurement.
So, George, there is going to be a lot of scientific concentration on this, and scientists are gathering already weekend after this, August 1 to 2, at Johns Hopkins University's Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel, Maryland, and they're going to try to discuss exactly what they want to do with the Bryson balloon and several other, they've got telescopes, they've got spacecraft, and because the right now, Comet Ison is behind the sun and won't be coming out to be seen again for a while, they want to use this period to try to see how much they can bring to bear and focus on all of this. And it's also interesting to me in talking with Dr. Hibbets that this balloon technology that can get them up so high, 23, 24, 25 miles, and then it can come down, which means that they are preserving what they have as equipment. And he said, after this, after Comet Ison, they're going to turn around and probably get ready for another comet that was discovered only on January 3rd of this year in Australia at the Siding Spring Observatory. And this is very interesting. It is being called Comet Siding Spring. And it is scheduled now that the comet is going to pass extremely close to Mars on October 19th, 2014, so a little more than a year from now, with a very, this is a quote now from one of the websites, quote, with a very small possibility of an impact event on the planet Mars. This is October 19th, 2014. And Dr. Hibbets and others will probably be organizing this balloon observatory to monitor what's happening near Mars, just like they're going to do now with what's going to happen with Comet Ison, and that they're going to have to work so early because of winds, weather. I think people underestimate how difficult science is when you have something that is moving fast to the sun, past the Earth, at different seasons. So for those of you listening, November 28th, that may be the morning to get up and see how bright Comet Ison is when it gets the closest to the sun, because nobody knows if it's going to survive what is called sun grazing.
Be an interesting Thanksgiving weekend for people, Linda, huh?
Yes. I certainly will get up to go out and see.
Sure will. Well, let me tell you something. Britain, not only known for royal babies, but also crop formations. And that's another story that Linda will look into when she comes right back on Coast to Coast AM. Now, a couple little things. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, if you would. We're getting real close to another Facebook milestone. So just go to our website. It's in the far right-hand corner. Just click it and follow us on Facebook, if you would. If you haven't signed up yet for the free Coast Zone newsletter, you can do that by going to coasttocoastam.com as well. We'll be back with more stories with Linda on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, conversations with Linda, your calls, your interactiveness. And when we come back in a moment, let's talk about these crop formations in Britain on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Linda, the crop formation phenomena just continues to baffle me. How about you?
Well, it's very important for you and our Coast and Earth Files audience for this segment, this half hour, to see what we're talking about. And if you go to earthfiles.com, I have a series of photographs that show this remarkable, what's called the Ridgeway pattern of nine rings. And you need to see how they are laid out. You need to see how they are thick and thin, and that it will relate to this discussion, which all really, if you said, is there one sort of big category in crop formations that this fits in? It is the mathematical language question that the crop formations have raised now for 30-some years. What is the intelligence behind them? It is a genuine phenomena. And why is it that in some of them, they seem to be focusing on astronomy, which also is mathematically related, and in others, they seem to be either testing our ability to come up with what is the mathematical language. And in this one, these nine rings that appeared on July 6, 2013, it's in an area called West Overton in Wiltshire County in England, and it is not very far from the big double stone circles of apiary that goes back 4,500 years. And it's on a place called the Ridgeway. And for at least 5,000 years, travelers in southern England have moved more easily from the Dorset coast to Norfolk by going up along this high, drier ground that they've called the Ridgeway all this time. And it's now designated as an 87-mile-long national trail in the UK. And part of it is Overton Hill near Avebury. And this is where these nine rings spanning 186 feet, this is not small, these are large. And Charles Mallett, director of the Silent Circle Research Center, went out there and did a lot of meticulous measurements. And I have all of that listed at my news website, earthfiles.com, all of the widths of each of the rings, the spaces in between the center circle and so forth. Now, the question that came up on July 6th came to me in an email from Horace Drew, also known as Red Collie to a lot of people. He's a retired geneticist in Sydney, Australia. And he was analyzing an aerial photograph of this Ridgeway-Overton pattern that had first appeared to all of us in different websites July 6th, which means he was studying it July 7th in Australia. And he made up a graphic and sent it to me and a few others, and he raised the question, could this be an Einsteinian physics mathematical concept called a Schwarzschild radius? Wikipedia defines a Schwarzschild radius or a gravitational radius as, quote, the radius of a sphere such that if all the mass of an object is compressed within that sphere, the escape speed from the surface of the sphere would equal the speed of light, close quote. And clearly, that sounds like a black hole, doesn't it?
It sure does.
And this goes back to 1915, Carl Schwarzschild, that's how it got the name. He was calculating this radius solution in connection with Einstein's general theory of relativity all the way back then, and this whole concept of black holes. Well, you can say, why would any intelligence be putting this down in wheat on the Ridgeway, the 5,000-year-old Ridgeway in July 6th of 2013. We don't have answers, but you can see Horace Drew's comments and illustrations about this Schwarzschild radius analysis at earthfiles.com. And there is another important aspect of this Ridgeway ring, again, in a mathematical context. The rings appear to have been formed consistent with the musical diatonic scale, the white keys on a piano. I did a lot of work on that with Gerald Hawkins, the mathematician and astronomer, for my book, Glimpses of Other Realities 1 and Glimpses of Other 2. And he was convinced also that we were dealing with diatonic ratio scales, scale ratios in crop formations that he analyzed. And again, why? Why would something be working with diatonic ratios, the white keys, in the rings, the circles, and some of the patterns in crop formations? Well, Lucy Pringle has been very interested in the diatonic ratios, the musical aspects of crop formations, in the 25 years that she has been investigating, doing beautiful aerial photography, and doing research in crop formations. And she sent me some of her aerials of this Ridgway Nine Rings. And she emailed that she had been in on the ground twice and was so impressed with these nine rings, and that she wanted me to know that they were so difficult to find. She said the pattern cannot be seen from the ground, only from the air. Here is Lucy Pringle from Wiltshire, England.
The Ridgway Formation, when I went in, all the crop was laid clockwise. And there was obviously very special and significant differences between distance of the rings from one ring to the next and to the next. And when I got into the center, there's music in a circle. And I thought, well, I can't wait to get home and send my overhead picture to Jim Lahns, who will work out the effects and what was going on. I think he will tell you that the major diatonic ratio was present in that circle, together with a whole lot of other geometry. The musical ratios and the distance between the rings, there is nothing average about it, Linda.
Right.
They are all different. It's as though you're going down a scale in music. This, I think, is very important to talk to Jim Lahns, because this enables him to make the interpretation that he has about the musical content based on the distances between the rings. Will then tell you about the diatonic ratios.
From the aerial photos that you have taken that I've looked at, this Ridgway Avebury, the Nine Rings, stands out as being in the phenomena category.
I would agree with that. I've been doing this for 25 years, Linda, and I know my own reactions. And that one, to me, it had the most lovely atmosphere within it. And it was true to the genuine phenomenon. Some magic. This certainly did for me. I went in twice, and that is one hell of a hike.
And if I understand correctly, the Ridgway near Avebury, that pattern is very difficult to get to, and it cannot be seen from the ground. It can only be seen from the air.
Absolutely, and that is why when we were going to do the control test, if two people hadn't actually been standing up in the circle in the field, I don't believe we'd have ever found it. And it seemed as though it was God's sense that they stood up, because I was driving along and trying to keep myself away from the rust. We couldn't see. We could see absolutely nothing whatsoever.
Lucy Pringle has been working with UK aeronautical engineer James Lyons for several years. Mr. Lyons worked in the aerospace industry for companies including McDonnell Douglas and British Aerospace from the mid-1960s to the mid-1990s, when he shifted to university teaching of environmental engineering and computer science. About crop formations, Jim Lyons' hypothesis was that if electrical discharges were involved in the energy creating crop formations, that would interact at the molecular and atomic levels. One result might be fusing nitrogen and oxygen together into nitrites. So Jim wanted to analyze the crop formations for their nitrogen content. What he and Lucy Pringle have found is that the nitrogen levels in sampled crop formations show dramatic nitrogen change, with higher levels inside the pattern compared to outside the pattern. When Lucy sent Jim Lyons her aerial photographs of the July 6, 2013 Ridgway Avebury Nine Rings, he immediately thought of toroidal energy.
The first reaction was the nine rings, which would really interpret as eight toroids. So you've got a large toroid in the outside, gradually getting smaller and smaller as you work towards the center. That's in three dimensions. And these form a geometrical series. And the numbers are absolutely crucial. There are nine rings, but eight spaces between them. And the eight spaces are the diatonic musical scale, the white notes on the piano, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. And these rings going from outside to inside are going up one octave. The two numbers involved nine rings, but eight toroids. If you divide the number eight by nine, which is a harmonic ratio, it's generally represented as nine over eight, this goes back to Mr. Pythagoras, in 300 and whatever it was BC, and that is a major tone on the diatonic scale. So the ratio 8 over 9 gives rise to the number 0.8888, or approximately 0.89. And that number occurs everywhere in physics. The way the cosmos organizes itself is largely on the basis of the harmonic sequence of the diatonic scale. And I first discovered this in stone circles many years ago, and then Gerald Hawkins got involved with spotting this diatonic scale, and I had to tell him that we already knew about this from Earth Energies a long time before he'd worked it out for ancient sites. But the whole thing about those rings on this latest one is that the number 8 is crucial to this formation. And it's the way in which the waves are wound around the toroid. It's like a slinky toy. If you take a slinky and put the two ends together, wrap it round one another so it should become circular, open it up in the center, you have the basic shape that fits everything from crop circles right the way up to galaxies. It's the universal shape. And it is the spiraling of those waves in this toroidal fashion which are the key thing. Because when you stretch these things out to a slinky wave just in a straight line, they do line up along the energy lines. And energy lines that people talk about, ley lines, and ley is just an old English word for meadow. So ley lines is just a line across the meadow. But all 13,000 medieval churches in Britain are built on the crossover of these energy lines. And these energy lines are three-dimensional slinky patterns. Ley lines are not just single lines, they are a set of lines. And certain of these lines are totally directional. And the direction in which the crop flows depends entirely on the direction of the energy on these north, south, east, west lines. We know now how it's segmented in terms of the musical scale. Effectively, a crop circle is really within a hemisphere. The bottom part of the hemisphere goes below ground. So it's a total sphere. And that is the way the whole of the energy moves in three dimensions. When you look at a crop circle, do not think of it in two dimensions. When you look at a crop circle or in a stone circle, think three-dimensionally.
That you're looking through a cross-section in the crop formation.
Like slicing a fruit, such as a grapefruit, which has got 12 segments, or a lemon, which has got 8 segments.
What is it that would provoke these energies from below the ground or above the ground to compartmentalize grass or crops into such sophisticated patterns?
The patterns, in my opinion, are related to the conscious input. The simple shapes that we have seen in the early days are perfectly natural ones. We even looked at ones that occurred in Yorkshire in the 1920s. And they largely are very simple circles. The key thing which goes back to the fundamentals of the linking of man to his environment, we are living in a quantum brain, okay? And the mechanism of how things operate in this quantum brain are just the same things that happen in crop circles. It's the same numbers turn up in the quantum scenario as they do in crop circles, and the same shapes turn up. With toroids, and you end up with conical flows.
Well, I wonder if you would comment on one scientist's speculation that the 9 rings at the Ridgeway on July 6th were in fact a Schwarzschild radius, which is used to define the radius of a sphere in terms of toroidal energy. A black hole would be an example of something in which Schwarzschild radii mathematics could be applied from all of your aerospace experience and working with toroids and fluid dynamics. Do you think that this is a correct possible interpretation looking through a cross-section of a Schwarzschild radius?
Schwarzschild radius is getting a spaceship to escape from the Earth. If you don't send it fast enough, it drops back to Earth again. And the Schwarzschild radius is the escape radius. So if you draw the analogy of the Schwarzschild radius as being the edge of the bubble that I'm talking about, then you're absolutely right. Because you can do measurements on a crop 1 inch inside a crop circle, and the energy in the crop is dramatically different from 1 inch outside the circle. That is the boundary, and that's akin to a Schwarzschild radius. I've taken it much further to the equivalent in fluid dynamics, and it really comes down to what we call in fluid dynamics the Magnus effect. I don't know whether you've heard about the Magnus effect, but it's the way a spinning object in space moving forward curls in its trajectory. And if you spin something fast enough, as you move it forward, it will close on itself into a circle. And that's the way in which the crop flows in a crop circle. Similar concepts.
But what is causing the spirals to manifest in the crops?
It's either us or something out there wanting to interact with us. And I'm not going to go any further than that, to be perfectly honest. All we have to accept is that the cosmos or the quantum brain, call it whatever you like, is in fact a conscious element. And we are but a subunit thereof.
They just keep coming, don't they, Linda?
Yeah. And I think back to all of the time that I spent with astronomer and mathematician Gerald Hawkins on crop formations and diatonic ratios back in the 90s. And in my fourth book, Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles, I have a whole section with him about the work that he was doing on not only the diatonic ratio analysis, but geometries that he found in Barbary Castle in a formation that went back to 1991. And those particular geometry concepts he put out as a challenge and put money. He put his own money behind it and put a challenge in one of the mathematic journals and said, anyone who can look at this pattern, and it was a photograph of this Barbary Castle pattern, and give me the five geometry theorems that are in it but are not in Euclid and are not in college geometry texts, and I will pay you whatever. I don't remember what the amount was, and that was standing for like 4 or 5 years, and no one cracked it. And he had put the formulas that he had found, the particular geometries that he had found, he had them in a safe in a sealed envelope. They had been held by somebody in an institute. And that shows that there were mathematical concepts back in 1990 that this mathematician and astronomer who had studied Stonehenge.
Well, it's one of those mysteries of the world, Linda. Back in a moment.